Welcome to the Speechy Side Up podcast. If this is your first time listening, then thanks for coming. This podcast is produced every week for your enjoyment. You can also follow along on Instagram at Speechy Side Up. This episode is a little different than my other episodes as it's available for ASHA CEUs through TASL Continuing Education. If you want to earn ASHA CEUs, then stay on until the very end because that is where I provide information on how to register for automatic ASHA reporting. Before we get started, we have some information to share. Let's start with the learning outcomes. As a result of this activity, you will be able to identify three ways that language, motor, and reading impairments can co-occur with CAS. You'll be able to describe procedural learning and why it's significant in children with CAS and other disorders. Describe at least three factors that distinguish CAS with other speech developmental disorders and explain the importance of treating the whole child when it comes to this population. Now let's talk about our financial and non-financial relationships. I have ownership interests in Speechy Side Up LLC and TASL Learning LLC, and I receive royalties from the Luno's What to Do book series. I'm also a member of ASHA Special Interest Group 12. Dr. Eugenie Siegel has the following relevant financial relationships to disclose. She's a salaried employee of Marquette University, and she's on the PAC at Apraxia Kids. She currently receives funding from Marquette and the Once Upon a Time Foundation and has no non-financial relationships to disclose. Now let's talk about the agenda for today. This is the most exciting part, and I think you're really going to enjoy this course today. We're going to start with introductions and backgrounds and then get into the description of language, motor, and reading impairments and how they can coexist with CAS. We're going to talk about procedural learning and the significance of using it in children with CAS and other disorders. We're going to have a discussion about ways to differentiate CAS and other speech sound disorders. And finally, we'll wrap up with a discussion of the importance of treating the whole child and how that plays a factor when treating children with childhood apraxia of speech. Today, I'm joined by Dr. Eugenie Siegel, a professor and director of the Communication, Movement, and Learning Lab at Marquette University, where she aims to identify factors that contribute to disorder onset and resolution for children with communication disorders. Her research centers on speech development and its disorder with specific focus on childhood apraxia of speech. Currently, she is interested in a multi-level approach to determine the relation among procedural learning and speech, language, and motor deficits in children with childhood apraxia of speech. Now that we've got all that covered, let's get started. Hi, Dr. Eugenie Siegel. Thank you so much for coming.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
I'm so excited to learn more about you and your research. So can you tell the listeners a little bit about yourself and before we get into our topics and questions?
Absolutely. So I'm from Brooklyn, New York. And when I was an undergrad, I actually studied studio arts and anthropology. But when I was a senior in college, my father had a right hemisphere stroke, and that is what introduced me to the amazing world of speech pathology. So, you know, he needed the full gamut of like all the assessments, swallowing and cognition and speech, and then he needed some intervention as well. And I just thought it was such an amazing field. Like you could focus on all of these different areas and it was all under one profession. I just thought that was unbelievable. So I decided when I would go back to graduate school someday that that's what I wanted to focus on. And I've really loved it ever since. I started studying childhood apraxia of speech during my master's program. I worked with Karen Forrest in her lab. She's getting ready to retire. This was at Indiana University. And we did some treatment work and looked at oral motor therapy. Spoiler, that obviously is not a good thing. Mm-hmm. I continued on for my doctorate. I just had a lot of questions that I wanted to answer and thought that would be the way to do it. But I also got to work clinically at a hospital. And so I was seeing, it was a small rural hospital, and I was able to see all kinds of patients. So adults, children, I was doing swallowing assessments and modifieds. And that really has served me so well because I can kind of teach in anything, and I've got a lot of clinical stories to share when I do that. I continued on. I did my dissertation. I started doing a postdoc and ultimately ended up at Marquette University, which I love. And I do kind of different types of research, treatment research and research into assessment. Basically, I'm just trying to find the best way to serve the whole child and, you know, for children with different kinds of speech sound disorders.
That's awesome. Thank you so much for sharing your background. It's amazing how everybody kind of gets into the field of speech language pathology.
Yes, for sure.
I know in my particular case, there wasn't an undergrad program at my school, so I knew nothing about speech language pathology, hadn't been exposed to it. And then my sister-in-law, she's a physical therapist, and she was like, you should look into this field. You'll always have a job. And, you know, they were related to physical therapy. And so I started looking into it. I took a linguistics course and loved it. And the rest is history. But yeah, it's amazing. And I'm sorry that that happened to your dad. And that's kind of what brought you into the field. But it's amazing how those things work out.
It really is. It really is. I don't think I really even knew what a speech pathologist was before that experience. Like, I think I would have thought, oh, they help kids to, you know, say S right or something, but I had no clue, you know, that swallowing problems was a thing or, you know, what a stroke was. It's just really amazing. Like, you know what you know. But yeah, it was an interesting path to get here.
Yeah, it sounds like it. Well, let's talk more about your research interests, specifically how language, motor, and reading impairments co-occur with childhood apraxia of speech.
Yeah, so children with childhood apraxia of speech, for, you know, many of the clinicians, this is no surprise, tend to have a lot of co-occurring issues. And it's something I'm really interested in because, you know, of course, it's considered a speech sound disorder. But at the same time, we very commonly see language impairments, definitely expressive language impairments, but we also sometimes see receptive language impairments. Along with that, we will end up seeing reading impairments. And this is in at least 50% of children with CAS. Wow. So it's very common. And unfortunately, because of the severity of the speech sound issue, a lot of children are actually like kind of underdiagnosed with these problems too. So that's of course a big issue because if you don't identify a problem, you're certainly not going to be treating it. And I think that sometimes clinicians can get overwhelmed by, you know, how much time they need to be putting in to help the child to remediate the speech issue. But if you leave the language or the reading impairment on the side, that child is going to for sure have ongoing problems like well into adulthood. We also interestingly see that they have motor impairments, so fine and gross motor impairments. And this is a really important topic for me. I'm just so interested in this, like what links these different things together? How well are children being diagnosed? And they're not. Like a child will come into my lab and be very obviously discoordinated. Like if I ask a child to do jumping jacks just to kind of burn off some energy or something, they will inevitably be very discoordinated with that. Or you can just tell from watching them interact with toys, manual dexterity is a lot of times poor, or they might be even like having difficulty sitting in a chair, like sitting still in a chair, or their balance might be a little bit off, like all kinds of things like this. And unfortunately, they are underidentified. They may be sort of, you know, physically able enough to achieve milestones. So maybe they crawled late, but they crawled, and they walked late, but they walked. But maybe the quality of those abilities was not great. So, you know, this is really very problematic. And I know even my son is just turning 19 months today. And he was a very tiny baby when he was born, and then it quickly escalated and he got very chubby. And he sat really early, like five and a half months. But then he did not progress. He did not crawl. And I really had to like advocate and, you know, really like very, you know, firmly request a physical therapy evaluation. And the pediatrician who I love was like, well, you know, he'll probably be fine. I mean, he's achieving like a later milestone. He's able to sit. That's a later milestone than rolling. Oh, he wasn't even rolling, actually. And so, you know, I thought, well, I don't know. I think he should be rolling. Like he can't access his environment, right? That's going to for sure impact him. And so we went for a physical therapy eval, and the therapist was just like, oh my goodness, like he is on a 3-month level for a lot of things. And this was at 9.5 months. So it was really just, you know, very eye-opening. And it was like exactly what I was seeing in all these children in my lab who come in with CAS, who, you know, did have like co-occurring motor impairments. They had just never been identified by their pediatrician. They had never been referred because of that. And it's very problematic. It leaves like a big gap. So anyway, I'm really interested in what links together these different kinds of disorders.
Well, first of all, I want to say good for you for advocating for your son. You know, I just had a baby. We're about 7 weeks in and I'm experiencing similar things. And like you love the pediatrician, but you find that they know what they know. And maybe that's the extent of it in terms of like the newest research. Maybe we have to do a little bit more digging on our own, or just given our field, we are able to identify things based on developmental milestones that are kind of alarming to us. But it is a little bit scary that parents that aren't in this field may not know to do that.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And I think it's really interesting that you talked about the co-occurring issues. I'm just going to give another example. My daughter had a lip and tongue tie, and the pediatrician wasn't concerned, but the lactation consultant was, and I was, you know, being a speech pathologist. So we went to the pediatric dentist, and sure enough, it needed to be released. And the dentist said that, more often than not, when they see the lip tie, there's going to be a tongue tie. So I think it's really interesting that we're kind of seeing that with childhood apraxia speech, that there's these co-occurring issues as well. Mm-hmm. And I know you said it's in about 50%. That's significant.
Yeah, it's really, I mean, language impairment is really probably more like 80%.
Wow.
Motor impairments, in my lab, it's at least 80% that we see that. But I tend to get more severe kids in my lab, I think, than maybe the general population of children with CAS. I'm sort of still getting to the bottom of this. But yeah, it's really significant. It's really significant. And when children have language impairments, they are at really increased risk for having all kinds of academic difficulties, literacy, you know, difficulties. And that extends, like we end up seeing long-term, you know, difficulties with social emotional health, with vocational outcomes. So these are not small things that can be sort of glossed over or brushed, you know, under the rug or something. They are really things that we need to be very, you know, very proactive in assessing and treating.
Right. So is it safe to say that if a clinician is working with someone that has childhood apraxia speech, or they diagnose it, that they should also be doing these language assessments as well as maybe reading assessments as well?
100%. And I think it's really important that they do standardized assessments. And so I think people sometimes are reluctant to do that when there is a severe speech deficit, but I think we tend to overestimate ability when we don't do that. So, you know, I know like a lot of parents will say, oh, my kid understands everything. And I'm sure they understand a lot, but it's really important if a child has like a receptive language impairment, which we can test if, you know, even with a severe speech impairment, we absolutely need to know that. Even if they're kind of, you know, performing like a standard score of 80 or something, that is very different than a child who's giving a, you know, a standard score of 100 or 110 or something like that. So, you know, we really need to do right by these children. They do not need anything else to hold them back. We want to give as much as we can to them. And it's hard too, because caseloads are really tricky. I know how overwhelming it can be for individuals working in the schools and even in private practice. You know, you can be overwhelmed by the amount of therapy that a child will need and whether, you know, to what extent you feel like you're able to provide that. Mm-hmm. It's really a lot of challenges.
Yeah, that's really interesting. So in terms of standardized assessment, do you have any that you tend to use or recommend?
Yeah, we tend to use the SELF-P or the SELF-5 in my lab. And we even will try, like for instance, with the expressive language piece, we will try and give children the benefit of like looking at their speech. If they have any kind of substitution patterns, we would try and give them credits for, you know, using, you know, like for instance, possessive S or something like that. If we can tell that when they're, you know, typically saying words with, you know, an S, you know, that they use a specific substitute. The problem is children with CAS don't tend to have patterns. They're so inconsistent. And so it can be really hard to do that. Whereas a kid with a phonological disorder, you know, maybe they stop their S or something like that, and we can kind of give credit. A lot of times it's hard. But for instance, with, you know, like if the child is, if we're trying to elicit ing, and they mark that with a syllable, even just a vowel syllable, we will try and give credit for that just to see, you know, where their score comes out. Because you don't want to overly penalize this, you know, child that has severe speech impairment, obviously.
That makes sense. I'm glad that you clarified that. Thank you.
Sure.
Let's talk now about procedural learning and what it is, why it's significant in children with childhood apraxia of speech and other disorders.
Yeah, so procedural learning, it refers to the system by which patterns are like implicitly learned and automatically acquired through practice, but without being explicitly taught. So for instance, like when you're a kid and you're doing those hand games like Miss Mary Mac or Boom, Clap, Flap, those kinds of things we acquire through procedural learning. We also use procedural learning to acquire patterns in grammar. So grammatical rules, you know, you're not really explicitly taught a lot of grammatical rules. You might be taught about the irregular ones, but the regular rules, you're typically just acquiring them throughout development. What we think is going on and what our preliminary research is showing is that children with CAS who have these comorbid language and motor impairments, they perform differently on tests of procedural learning. And the way that we assess procedural learning in my lab is we use a test called the serial reaction time task. And it's basically a computer game. So we use a touch screen computer, and there'll be four boxes across the screen, like going horizontally. And a puppy, a picture of a puppy, will appear in one of the boxes, and the child will touch it to make it go away. And then the puppy will appear in another box. And they basically just touch, you know, where the puppy is to make it go away and make the next puppy appear. And there's two different conditions. So one, the puppy appears in a sequence order. So it might go like 1, 4, 3, 1, 4, 3, like moving across the screen in that same order each time. Does that make sense to you?
Yeah.
Okay. So like maybe like first square, then, you know, the rightmost square, then the middle square, like back and forth, that kind of thing. And it will go over and over in a sequence. And the child will just keep, like, you know, touching where the puppy appears. And if they have good procedural learning over time through repetition and practice of this little task, they will get faster and faster and faster. We then introduce a random order condition. So now instead of the puppy appearing in that same sequence order, the puppy kind of like randomly pops up in those squares, and the kid again is just touching the screen to make the puppy go away. What we should see if a child has good procedural learning is that they get faster and faster on the sequenced trials. And then when we introduce that random block towards the end of this task, when we go to the, when we get to the end of the task and we introduce that random order condition, the child will get slower again because they've implicitly learned the sequence through that practice. But then when you introduce this new novel order, they haven't learned that, right?
Right.
So we'll see them get slower at that point. What we see with children with apraxia is that they start off slower than children without apraxia, which is not surprising. A lot of them have these motor difficulties, like we said. But then during the second sequence block, so we do like 50 trials per block, during that second sequence block, instead of them getting faster, they get slower. And after that, they do get faster. So like by the end of the task, they have learned. But there's something different about their learning process where they are getting slower during that second block. We don't know why, but we know that they do it. That's what my most recent paper that was just recently accepted at JSLHR, that's what it showed. So it's really interesting. And if they're having difficulty with this pattern learning, think of all the ways that that will manifest. right? We're going to see problems with the grammatical rule learning. We're going to see problems with acquiring of motor skills. Reading is all about patterns, right? So all of these things are connected, we think, through that procedural learning system. And we think that children with CAS are really having difficulty with this.
Wow, that's really fascinating.
Thank you.
So I know in the second condition, the randomized condition, it seemed like both populations, it was slower than the sequential after they learned it, but it seems to be a lot slower with the children with CAS, correct?
They are slower, yeah, by like a few hundred milliseconds per trial.
Okay, that's what I was going to ask, like how much slower.
Mm-hmm.
Wow, that's interesting. And how much longer does it take them to kind of get up to speed with the children who are typical?
So that's a really good question. We haven't gotten there yet. They have not gotten there in general. They've not gotten there by the end of five blocks of trials. So 550 trial blocks. They've not gotten up to speed, but their learning pattern looks similar by the end. So like they've definitely progressed and they've learned. And we think that this really reflects why or helps to explain why they require such intensive and frequent therapy compared to children with, say, like a phonological disorder. Does that make sense? So if they're requiring like all these extra trials potentially to get up to speed and their learning process is different, then it's really easy to understand why you really need to be doing like 100 to 200 trials per treatment session.
Yeah.
Because if they're not getting that practice, they're not going to be able to get down that learning.
That's really interesting. And I'm wondering if it's randomized too, and that's just something that they have like a deficit in, it's always going to be like a surprise to them, I guess you could say, in like layman's terms, when a new target is presented. So I wonder how that plays out in like treatment as well. Like, should you be doing like this, like instead of doing randomized, which would make sure that they're not learning like the pattern? I don't know. Do you get what I'm kind of asking?
Are you asking about like the benefits of giving the same target over again versus like mixing up the targets in treatment?
Okay. Yes, thank you.
No, that's a great question. So actually that really speaks to like principles of motor learning. And I don't know if this is something you're familiar with, but if you are really into apraxia, like you've heard of it. So basically there are certain things that will promote learning within a treatment session. Or gains within a treatment session. Those are considered performance gains. But there's other things that will help to promote learning and generalization long-term. So typically we say that if you practice like the same thing over and over again, block practice like that, that the child will probably get better within a session. They'll show performance gains. However, this does not necessarily generalize to retention and learning from like a generalization standpoint.
Okay.
We will say that random presentation and like mixing up the targets, those things will promote generalization and like long-term learning. So with kids with CAS, like you want them to have that early success, you want them to get down these patterns, but you really need to also then extend that to mixing up the targets so that they can really like have that long-term learning and generalization. And actually in my lab, we do really mix up the targets. So when we're doing a treatment study, I don't give the child the same treatment word 10 times in a row. Because it's almost like if I were to give you a complex math problem right now and have you figure it out, it would take you a minute, you would figure it out. And then if I asked you again, like a minute later, maybe you would have to figure it out one more time. But if I asked you to solve this problem for me 10 times in a row, probably by the third time, you wouldn't actually have to figure it out anymore. You would just like retrieve the answer because you had just done it, right? It's like different than having to fully plan out and solve that problem. Do you know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
That sort of is like what I think about when I'm working with kids with CAS, that we really want to train them to be making these motor plans. That's what they're having difficulty with, motor planning and programming. So we want them to have to really do this work during treatment each time. If I have them just say the same word 10 times in a row, that is not requiring them to do the same work. So it's almost like a shortcut or a cheat. And we don't want to do that. Like this is what they have difficulty with. This is what we really need to be working. It's not just like our tick therapy or phonological therapy. It's really like they need to be working that motor plan and program, you know, as much as possible. So you really want to do like a hybrid. You might do, you know, one target a few times in a row and then move on to the next target. That's typically what I do in treatment.
Okay, great. Thanks for sharing that. And thanks for clarifying my question. I appreciate it.
No, sure. It's a great question.
So what's next for this area of your research? Congratulations on the article being published, by the
way. Thank you. Yeah. Hopefully it'll be published early in the new year, I'm hoping. Ooh. But so what else are we doing? So actually, we are looking at making this procedural learning task a screener for children with multiple system deficits. So it has actually really good sensitivity in terms of being able to identify children with comorbid language and motor problems. So you know how we do like universal hearing screenings? My pie in the sky hope is that this may end up being a really robust way to test maybe like 4-year-old, 5-year-old kids to see if they have multi-system deficits. It won't tell you specifically what those deficits are, but our research so far is showing that it really indicates that the child is likely to have difficulty with motor and language and reading problems if they do poorly on this procedural learning task. So I'm working with Maria Grigos at NYU, Dr. Maria Grigos, and we're working on a grant submission now that would basically assess this and look to see how predictive it is in a large sample of children. So we'll see what the outcome of that is. And we're also looking at, I'm working with Laura Smith, who's an SLP. She has a nice Insta following too. I think she's SLP mommy of Apraxia.
Oh, yeah.
And so she's an SLP and her daughter has CAS. And then we're working also with Jordan Christian of Fighting for My Voice. And he is an adult with a diagnosis of CAS essentially, or he calls it, I think, verbal apraxia or speech apraxia, because he's an adult and it's weird to have a childhood diagnosis when you're, you know, 23 years old or something. But anyway, we're working together to develop a survey or a series of surveys that looks at the physical and emotional, social emotional experience of children with different kinds of speech sound disorders. I think because of COVID, so many children, like typically developing children, children with, you know, different kinds of disorders and disabilities have been having really limited access to physical activity, right? Like they're not in their group sports as much and a lot of things have really been cut down. So I think that's really shedding light on the importance of physical activity in children. I mean, obviously it's something we already know, but it's really becoming like, now it's an emergency because all of these children who are typically developing are not having access to these things. Kids with CAS, a lot of them, we think, like just in general, do not have access as much to physical exercise, to sports and things like that because of their potential physical limitations. And this can have a really significant effect on social emotional health. In addition, we know that a lot of children with severe speech sound disorders are bullied because of their speech. And so these are the kinds of questions that we're asking or will be asking families to help clue us in on. Like, what is your child's physical experience in the world? Do they perform as well as other kids their age? What is their social emotional health like? Do they feel anxiety related to their speech? So we're starting to look at that too. I'm working with two excellent students in my lab, Emily Olson and Jane Layden. And they're doing this as part of a fellowship at Marquette. And we've been having a lot of fun kind of getting this all figured out.
That's amazing. So this is going to be for parents. It's like a parent or a caregiver.
So interestingly, there's going to be a couple of different levels. So one will be for parents. One will be for adult individuals with speech sound disorders. So like Jordan could fill it out or, you know, any of his 20,000 Instagram followers who have CAS themselves could fill it out. And then we have another one that is going to be for actual children, probably children that are like 8 or 10 years old and older, because they're going to need to be able to read the survey to respond to it. But yeah, they'll be short, like 10 minutes each, and hopefully we'll get a really great response. And we're not just interested in the CAS community, but also in individuals with other kinds of speech sound disorders, like phonological disorder, or even like a long-standing or tic disorder. So, I mean, we want to be able to kind of compare these different populations, like even typically developing individuals, just to kind of know, you know, on an everyday basis, how much bullying does a typically developing child report, and then be able to compare that to kids with CAS or other types of speech sound disorders, like, you know, stuttering even.
Oh yeah, that's good. That makes sense.
Yeah.
So that's really interesting. Like, are you guys the first to develop something in regards to social emotional aspects, you know, with speech sound disorders?
So as far as we know, yes, in terms of like CAS, there is a lot for the stuttering community.
Right.
They have like actual like specific questionnaires that are used. There's even stuff for like individuals with voice disorders. You know, how does that impact somebody's quality of life and things like that? So there are a lot of quality of life measures. I think this is going to be the first that really gets into this in our Apraxia Warriors. And I think it's going to be really revealing and really important and kind of tell us, like, we need to be very mindful of this. It's so important when we see, you know, any kind of a patient. And this is something that is ingrained, you know, in me probably because of my dad's experience, but that you are treating the whole patient. This is like one of the biggest things that I try and hammer home when I'm teaching. You are working with someone who is the most important person to, you know, a parent, to a child, like to somebody. This person is like the entire world and you need to treat them as such. So, you know, if you see a child come into your clinic room and they are clumsy and they do not have a PT or OT diagnosis and they're not receiving intervention for that, you make that referral. You go that extra mile for this child because it's going to make all the difference in their world. Like, think about our kids that are so severely impaired in terms of their speech, being out like in the world, being out on the playground. And now this is also a child who like doesn't move as well as other kids. Like, what is their experience going to be like? Are they sitting by themselves every day at recess? You know, like we really need to be very mindful of the different ways that these different kinds of limitations are impacting somebody's full experience in the world and what that's going to look like now, what it's going to look like when they're an adolescent and when they're an adult.
Yeah, I love that. Thank you so much. I was thinking about the stuttering community as well. I had another professor on who is a person who stutters and was talking about the social emotional aspects and, you know, how they look at that in that field. Mm-hmm. You know, with fluency disorders, these social emotional aspects can kind of contribute to those like secondary behaviors.
Okay.
Is that like a case with childhood apraxia of speech, you think, or is it more about just like their self-esteem? You think it impacts that part?
I think it's an empirical question. We haven't really, there's not a lot of research to my knowledge on secondary behaviors in individuals with CAS. But that's not to say that it doesn't exist. I know Jordan Christian, who I was just mentioning, he really talks a lot about, like, for instance, talking on the phone or talking into like a drive-through at a, you know, at a restaurant or something, like going through the Krispy Kreme drive-through. He was talking about having really difficulty ordering. And the person at the, you know, the person working behind the counter was being really difficult to him and like, kind of like spit it out. Like, what are you trying to say? You know? And he was like, excuse me, I have a speech disorder. Like, can I just order at the window where I can see you? And they really gave him a hard time. And he's really used his voice to advocate in the most amazing way for himself and also for like every individual with a speech sound disorder. I am just endlessly impressed with what he does. And if you aren't following him already, you need to be following him.
Yes. Fighting for
my voice. Yeah, it's amazing. What did you say?
It's Fighting for My Voice. That's his.
Yes. Title. Yes. Absolutely. So, I mean, it just like really makes you think about just every minute of the day, how a speech sound disorder can be affecting somebody's life. Like you want to go order your donuts and that's not accessible to you because of the limitations of the business or of the training of the people working at the business. You know, we really need to be caring for the whole individual. And pediatricians, this is so interesting, but I read a study that said pediatricians refer to speech pathologists more than other allied healthcare professionals.
Really?
So they're, yeah, it's so interesting. And I think it's because it's like very apparent, right? When you're sitting in the pediatrician's office, if the child is talking, like, you know, the nurse or the pediatrician can hear like, oh, that doesn't quite sound right. But they do not usually have children run through any series of motor tasks, in my experience anyway. You know, they might like hold them up to see if they have appropriate tone, but they're not like having them roll or, you know, having them crawl or walk or doing any other number of things. So I'm not sure. Even my pediatrician said if it had been a speech issue, he would have referred my son, but because it was just about his physical abilities that he wasn't going to, I was like, well, my mind is blown because that seems pretty important.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, that's really interesting.
Yeah.
Oh, that's amazing. I'm sure there's some good ones out there that do that, or maybe they know a physical therapist. They have one in the family or something.
Right.
Those things, but otherwise, yeah. Very interesting.
Mm-hmm. So, there's a lot of wait and see.
Yeah.
Carrie Ebert says like uses like hashtag wait or let's just see. And I am fully on board for that. So instead of this wait and see, like, let's see what's different in 6 months. Let's just see because we can intervene then, you know?
Yeah.
And I'm really on board for that.
Yeah, me too. That with the tongue and lip tie for our daughter, it was a wait and see kind of approach too. And
mm-hmm.
We did it. When did we do it? At like 5 weeks, just yeah. Recently. And I'm like, I wish we did it week one because it made such
a
difference.
For sure. And nursing, I mean, 5 weeks is enough time for somebody to be like, this is not working. I'm going to stop nursing.
Exactly.
Right. That's like an eternity with a newborn.
We were getting by, but we were clearly not the best that, you know, the most efficient.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Which is a shame because we could have been from the beginning.
Right.
So on to the next topic. What tips do you have for differentiating childhood apraxia of speech and other speech sound disorders?
Yeah, so we have a couple of good papers on this. We use in my lab a checklist of features and we assess things and we have these operational definitions. So Liz Murray and I have a paper in Perspectives from 2017. And I also have a paper or a couple papers at least like in JSLHR, I think, that operationalize all of our feature definitions, because I think a lot of times, like, you know, we're reading a paper and the researcher is like, oh, they exhibited, you know, difficulty with co-articulation. And you're kind of like, well, what does that mean? Like, how do I measure that? So I have some ways that we like explicitly define these things, but we look a lot at features. So looking at co-articulatory transitions, looking at syllable segregation, are the kids sounding really choppy when they're speaking? Do they have vowel errors? That's a big one for CAS. We have a list of about 10 features. We also look at, and we assess these features in three different contexts. So usually the Goldman Fristo, and then we use a list of multisyllabic words, and then also in like connected speech. And if a kid is demonstrating each feature at least three times in each of those contexts, we would say that they are positive for that feature. And if they have five or more of those features, that they would be like a high risk for CAS. We also look at inconsistency. And you can look at this really in a variety of ways. You can look at it by having them say the same list of words multiple times and comparing if they say them the same or different. So we usually will have them do the Goldman Fristo twice, like on two different sessions, and then compare. We also look at the phonemic level, which is really good for preschool age children specifically. So we're looking to see for all S targets, do they produce the same substitute or are they producing like five different substitutes, you know, or distortions or omissions? Like, are they producing five different kind, you know, whatever number, but basically, if a child has 18% or higher anemic inconsistency, that's a red flag. And then our really quick and dirty one that we love to use is having the child say, "Buy Bobby a puppy," 5 times. And if they're inconsistent at all across those productions, that is a red flag also for CAS. It's really interesting. Like, you can have a child with a very severe phonological impairment and they will produce the sentence consistently. They may say it wrong, but they will be consistent across those productions. Typically, developing kids will be consistent across those productions. And this is really for like kids, you know, say 5 and older. If they are inconsistent, that's a red flag. And the reason why we use this sentence is, it was kind of like a happy accident at first, and then we ended up analyzing these productions, but it taxes the things that kids with CAS really have a hard time with. So the voicing distinction, right? Because you're getting the B's and the P's. Mm-hmm. It taxes a lot of different vowels. So buy Bobby a puppy, right? That's a lot of different vowels in a very short sentence. It has potential to hear the syllable segregation. It has potential to hear stress errors. And so all of these things are the things that children with CAS really have a hard time with, but kids with phonological disorders are really okay with. So we've found it to be a really useful assessment tool. And a lot of clinicians have tried it with their kids and written to me on Instagram saying that they tried it and like they couldn't believe that it worked so well, but that it was really like so informative.
Wow, that's awesome.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think, there was another sentence that I learned about in grad school for like assessing CAS just during like an OME. Do you know what that one is? Oh, I can't think of it right now, but that's great.
I
found one that.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I don't know that that one that I learned about in grad school actually differentiated between other.
Sure. Yeah.
Disorders, so it's nice to know that this one.
Yeah. There's a lot of sentences that look at like nasality, you know, things like that. So maybe that's one of the things that you're thinking of, like mama made some lemon jam or something like that. There's, you know, different kinds of sentences like that. And kids with CAS, a lot of times will have fluctuating resonance disturbance. So they're not like necessarily hypernasal all the time or hyponasal, like you might see with a child who has dysarthria, but it may go back and forth because, again, it's an issue with timing and coordination.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
So when you do the Goldman-Fristo twice, what do you tend to see in this?
Yeah, we will see any number of things. So a lot of times the productions will be completely different from each other. They might use a correct sound on occasion. A lot of times it'll just be incorrect in different ways. They may leave out full syllables on one and not the other. They may use glottal stops in one and not the other. And I mean, this is literally like word by word. They may just use totally different substitutes, so, or distortions. It's really interesting. It's just a really interesting population because they don't have patterns in general. However, that's not to say that they can't have a comorbid phonological disorder, because we absolutely see that. And a lot of times, as you treat a child with CAS, they become more consistent. And once they're more consistent, then you're able to kind of see what their phonological disturbance is. So you'll start to see errored patterns emerge, but you can't see it right away because it's just, they're so inconsistent initially. So once they become more consistent, you'll be like, oh, now they're like stopping, or, you know, they're doing this or that. It reveals itself, but you kind of have to wait for it sometimes.
Wow. Yeah. That's a lot for a speech language pathologist to consider. A lot of comorbid things going on, it sounds like.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
All right. So let's talk about, you've talked a lot about treating the whole child. So how does that play a part in treating children with childhood apraxia of speech?
So I think it means making appropriate referrals. It means testing, you know, whatever is in our domain to test. In really young ones, like, you may want to even assess feeding. In as children progress, you're absolutely going to want to, not even as they progress, but I mean, test language as soon as possible, test literacy and, you know, phonemic awareness and things like that as soon as it's age appropriate to do so. Pre-literacy skills, like all of these things can really clue you in, and then you want to intervene appropriately. So you can think about as you're doing treatment to also be doing that to some extent, like from a language perspective, or as the child starts to learn whatever speech sound targets, not speech sound targets, but like whatever word targets and that you're using, you can start to embed them in sentences too, and be working, you know, in that way as well. Literacy is one of those things that, again, you want to be hit it off at the pass, like language too. You just want to treat these things as early as possible, because if you don't, it's like they just keep popping up in a million different ways. And once a child has a literacy deficit, that's it. Like academics are going to be the biggest challenge, because you start off learning to read and then you really read to learn. And that's going to be how they're going to need to access all information for like the rest of their life, right? So it's just really essential that you do that work, to do the assessment, do the intervention, make the referrals.
That's, yeah, so important. What about making referrals for like physical motor impairments as well?
I think like early and often, we know that these kids are so predisposed to these issues. Really think about what that child's experience is like, advocate for them, have the parents advocate for them. If you suspect something and the school is unable to treat it because it supposedly is not affecting them academically, like a child can ambulate around the classroom, but you can see this doesn't quite look age appropriate, I would still like bring that up with the parents. You know, they may be able to get other therapy services for the child as well. And I've had a lot of parents that have done that, and they are amazed at the progress that their kid makes, because I think that you kind of, you know, you don't necessarily know, or you think like, well, maybe it's not that bad. But I think when you see what kind of improvement can be made, it's amazing. And then you're giving this child like such a better experience in the world, right?
Absolutely. Yep.
Yeah.
So if someone is listening to this and they're doing so to maybe learn more about childhood apraxia of speech, where do you recommend they start? And yeah, what type of like treatment suggestions do you
have? Sure. So there's a lot of really great resources online. Number one, Apraxia Kids website is phenomenal. It has tons of resources. Once Upon a Time Foundation also has a lot of online resources, and they've sponsored a video series by Edie Strand, Dr. Edie Strand, who used to work at Mayo Clinic. She's amazing and a real CAS expert as well. She talks a lot about treatment. So if you're looking to learn more about diagnosis and treatment, I would absolutely look on YouTube or on the Once Upon a Time websites and watch her videos. Like there's hours of videos that you can access, and you will be like brilliant by the end of watching. She talks a lot about dynamic temporal and tactile cueing therapy, which there's really good evidence and growing evidence for. In older children with apraxia, there's a therapy called REST, and it uses non-words, and it works on like prosody in part. So that can be really helpful for children that are a little bit farther along, that they don't quite sound natural still. They need to make more improvements, but they're past kind of where, you know, what you would use like DTTC for. On Instagram, I would absolutely follow my lab, of course, CML lab. What is, I don't even know what my, like Marquette CML lab, I think we are.
I'll look it up.
And then I would follow SLP Mommy of Apraxia. I would follow Jordan Fighting for My Voice. Carrie Eber posts a lot about apraxia. I don't know if I'm forgetting anyone, but those are some really good resources. Very evidence-based for a lot of them. And I'm like so impressed. I just joined Instagram over like the summer with my students. We decided to make a lab account, and I am amazed by the content that is available that clinicians are putting up. It is so high quality. There's so much evidence being reported. Like, as a researcher, this warms my heart like you can't imagine, because it shows that, like, the research is getting delivered to the people who, you know, need it and want it and who are doing the work. Research that sits in a lab or in a journal and nobody's reading, like, what's the point of that? So I love kind of, you know, being on Instagram and seeing what gets, what's trickling down, and like at a very rapid pace. Also, like, informed SLP is another one that I'm really into, because they just break it all down so that you can use your limited time that you have as a clinician to learn the best evidence. It's just so useful.
Yeah. Oh, I love all of those suggestions. And I looked up your lab. So it's Marquette_CML_lab.
Thank you.
And we'll make sure to include that in the handout for the pod course as well, so that no one Great. Has any trouble finding it.
Great. Thanks.
So talk about, as we're wrapping up, can you talk a little bit about some other research that you're working on right now? I know we talked about procedural learning and the screener that you're developing. What else have you got going on?
So I'm also writing a grant right now on the use of exercise training as sort of like an enhancement for speech therapy. So we don't know if this is going to work, but I've been doing some pilot research in my lab looking at having children do gross motor actions while they're doing speech practice. So like bouncing on an exercise ball, it sounds crazy, but it's really amazing. Bouncing on an exercise ball while producing speech targets. And it is amazingly facilitative. And so there's a lot of research on exercise training and just like even brief bouts of exercise in other populations, including like adults with Parkinson's disease, Alzheimer's, multiple sclerosis. It really increases neuroplasticity in the brain, which is what we're trying to do with speech sound treatment, right? So if we can think of ways to like really like find a catalyst for that neuroplasticity, like exercise, then that will be a big win, because we might be able to put in, we might be able to get faster gains from our same amount of effort, which would be phenomenal. So it might be like we're testing, you know, hoping to test this, but it might be as simple as having a kid do like a shuttle run, you know, for 5 minutes or something, or 10 minutes, that kind of an activity where they kind of get their heart rate up and get their blood flowing like before therapy, and then, or first thing in the morning, maybe, who knows. And then when we do therapy, we might be getting like a greater bang for our buck. So hopefully we'll, you know, get funded for that at some point in the next couple of years, and we can get rolling on that. But wouldn't that be cool?
Yeah, that's so cool. That's like really interesting. I was going to ask you if they were doing the targets with the exercises or separately. It makes sense that it would be separately, and you're seeing the same kind of progress.
So in our lab, we've been doing it simultaneously. But going forward, we're hoping to test it separately, because it is a little hard to be like giving them, you know, the models and everything as they're like bouncing on a ball, but we've really seen it work. We think we were testing originally this idea of like motor entrainment. So, you know, when you walk and your arms swing in rhythm to your legs, that's considered motor entrainment. Like one oscillating system of the body pulls in another oscillating system. So we were thinking that, oh, we'll pull the speech system into the motor system. Like they'll bounce on a ball and that will pull in the speech system and they'll get them producing speech better. And it seems like it did work. But now we're thinking, oh, well, maybe it was actually working because of increased neuroplasticity in the brain. So now we need to test that. But yeah, it's like fun stuff. That's, and I mean, maybe you see that. You're into, did I see like on your account, like, are you into Peloton?
I love Peloton. Yeah.
So do you feel like more clear-minded and quicker when you do your Peloton in the morning? I don't know when you do it, but.
Yes. And I was thinking it'd be really cool and probably a good form of like, I'm into assistive technology and AAC, but for these kids with childhood apraxia of speech, if that proved to be something that was beneficial, like a type of assistive technology schools could provide would be like those under the desk bikes, you know, the not bikes,
Pedals
maybe.
Yes.
Or I wonder if just it's something simple of like squeezing a, like those squishy balls would be like enough. I wonder how much activity they need to get to make an impact.
That is like exactly a question that we're wondering. And because it needs to be enough, but it can't be fatiguing.
Right.
So it's like really going to be a fine line. And I'm so excited to kind of see where that goes. I'm working on that with Professor Sandra Hunter at Marquette, and she's an exercise physiologist and just, you know, an awesome person. And so we're both just like nerding out every time we talk about this grant because it's just so exciting and different and fun.
Yeah. Yeah. Bring back mandatory playground time for kids.
Imagine that. Yes. Yes, absolutely.
Oh, wow. This has been awesome. Is there anything, was that the only research that you want to talk about? Do you have something else in the works?
Oh gosh, I don't know. We probably do. I mean, we're also working on a survey with Kelly Ferquharson of Class Lab on Instagram and Katie Cabbage. And we're developing a survey looking at what actually results in pediatricians making referrals. So do they make referrals for speech and physical therapy and things like that? Are they more likely if the parent demonstrates concern? Are they more likely if the child has multiple deficits? Like what causes them to wait and see? What are the obstacles in place? Like, is it due to insurance? Is it due to difficulty with the referral process? Do they not realize who to refer to? What milestones are they using? Like, what is their understanding of milestones? So we're looking at that as well. It's kind of fun. I've never done survey research until this year, but with COVID, it makes it really difficult to collect in-person data. So we've been trying to kind of think of other projects that we can work on in the meantime. And it's been fun to kind of think outside the box a little bit for us.
Yeah. And there's, I mean, sounds like these have like really big impacts in terms Hopefully. Of the survey, you know, mm-hmm. like the social yeah. emotional survey and this one with pediatricians. I'm sorry, did you say it was specifically to the CAS population or all?
No, that'll be just like pediatricians in general. Yeah.
Okay. Referring yeah. for speech and language disorders.
Yeah.
Okay.
Because I just like, I mean, even just from my personal momming experience and, you know, my friends who I chat with, it is amazing how many people will be like, yeah, my kid's not really speaking or they've had 6 ear infections. I'm like, get this kid in for tubes. Like, what is the question here? Why are we even holding off on this? Or, you know, they're not talking in their 18 months. Like, put this child in for a referral. Like, why are you not just making this referral? What are we waiting for? Like, what do we anticipate the benefit is going to be? Because either they're going to get intervention and start talking faster and no one's going to be upset about that, or 6 months are going to go by and they're going to still not be talking and then they're going to be in a worse place. And more frustrated and more likely to have long-term problems. Like, what is the benefit of the wait? I just don't get it.
Yeah. I mean, that's so interesting. I wonder if we have to just look back at what the medical textbooks say or what they're
right,
being
taught right.
in their programs.
Yeah.
They're just not left to speed. I mean, we could mm-hmm. talk about like the type of like the hepatitis shot. And I just know that those are things that are like recommended as a whole, but like the research is saying otherwise nowadays and the field hasn't caught up. So I'm assuming it's probably happening as well with, you know, the speech and language referrals.
I think too, like for instance, by 18 months, you know, like what is the milestone that they're saying? I think 50 words maybe, but the average is actually like hundreds of words. So mm-hmm. if a kid, you know, like I can anticipate maybe like some pediatricians are like, well, the kid is saying 30 words. So that's close enough to hitting yeah. the milestone. It's not like they're not talking at all. But then in reality, you're like, yeah, but I mean, my goodness, my child is saying like hundreds and hundreds of words. Like every time he hears a word, it's like a new word in his vocabulary, right? So I just think like, oh my gosh, like kids are just missing out. It's just not fair for them. And parents don't know, and they shouldn't have to know. You shouldn't have to be an expert in everything as a parent, but unfortunately, a lot of times it feels like that.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, and like we said in the beginning, we're kind of exposed to these things
yeah.
given our field, but parents that aren't, you know, that's
right. Right.
Kind of a shame. Mm-hmm. Well, where can everybody? I know we shared about your lab on Instagram. Is there anywhere else that you want people to go to learn more about your research?
For now, I'd say Instagram. We usually post if we have a new paper out or we post little tutorials and things. If you want to learn more about measuring inconsistency or Bybobby a puppy, we have posts on that that you can look back at with videos and things like that. But no, we would love to hear from you. And if you send us a message, I'll absolutely respond. Or if you want to email me if you have any questions. But it's really great to engage with clinicians. And yeah, we're just, always excited to do it.
Awesome. Well, thank you for extending that offer for people to reach out to you. I know a lot of people really appreciate that. And this has been such a pleasure. I've learned so much and can't wait to see how your research unfolds and how those surveys make an impact. It sounds like it's going to be very, very beneficial.
Well, thank you so much for having me on. This was really fun.
Oh, good. Was this the first podcast interview you've done?
No, I did. I've done a couple before, but I did See Here Speak with Dr. Tiffany Hogan. She does a lot about language and literacy, and I did my postdoc with her and Jordan Green, and so she's got this great podcast too, and I went on there and did that with her. It was pretty
Awesome.
fun. Yeah.
Great. Well, thank you so much for your time and coming on. And I can't wait for listeners to hear this.
Thank you.